This episode has been sponsored by Audioblocks.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Question and Answer Time with Adam Neely. I'm here answering all of your questions about bass and music in general. And just a quick reminder, these Q&As are now going to be available as podcasts on iTunes and SoundCloud. So in case you want to listen to my sultry voice talk about bass and music in the car or on the train or wherever you like to listen to podcasts, now you can. Anyway, let's get started.
Jake Waterman writes, Adam, do you have any tips for performance anxiety? I'm fine during live performances, but lately I found it very stressful to record. I can play one song in particular perfectly during practice or even playing in front of other people, but when I am trying to track it, it's as if there's a mental block preventing me from nailing it. Take after take, I get more and more anxious and eventually have to go on a long break before trying again.
Recording is a very difficult thing to do from a psychology standpoint, especially when you're in this like an actual studio with other people versus like just trying to record at home, because it requires you to be absolutely focused on the moment and not get inside your head, because it's very easy while you're tracking a take to be playing and then notice that you might not have played something as well as you might have wanted to. And then that's the only thought that's going to be going on in your head for a long period of time, causing you to completely ruin the vibe and just completely lose track of where you are in the music. And that, of course, is not very productive. And you can get into the cycle into these like spirals of just getting inside your head. And it can be very difficult. It also can be difficult because if you just keep recording the same thing over and over and over again, there becomes a point where the quality starts to decline. And I've always heard it is the seventh take. Never do any more than seven takes. I mean, me personally, I think it's actually closer to four takes because you should be practiced enough to be able to like get something good out of four takes when you're playing with other people. After the seventh take, forget it. It's all going to be garbage. The long and short of it is that recording is a thing that you have to practice, at least getting into that mindset, getting into the mindset of like being okay with whatever happens and just letting it go. Kind of like a live performance. But the difference is like you're going to be nitpicking details, and the time and place for nitpicking details is in the recording booth when you're editing, not necessarily when you're actually recording. It requires a very different mindset. So I hope that gave you some insight into my thought process for the recording. Just try and stay in the moment.
Eat More Bagels 27 writes, Hi Adam, I have a slightly nitpicky correction. You say that you can hear the grief in Bach's piece, but at the time composers didn't really put their own emotion into their music. That wasn't common until the Romantic era. Although we can't know for sure, any feeling of grief in Bach's piece is likely a coincidence.
I do understand that, and thank you very much for bringing up that point. And yes, it is a more contemporary understanding of the role of the composer and the musician to think about like a romantic outpouring of emotion and an expression of self, and I am the creator, and you know, look at me and pay attention to me because of my expression and my great depth of beauty and etc. And that, of course, is a rather selfish sort of understanding, but is the understanding that we have today for sure. But it definitely wasn't always the case. Bach was a very religious man, and he never would think about himself in his compositions. That just, of course, was not, to him, not the role of the composer. That was kind of an alien understanding. He was looking to try and capture the glory of God through music and try and exalt God and try and share in the glory of God with his fellow man. That said, there is a, like, this perception of Bach's music that's persisted throughout the centuries, and it's certainly the case today, although maybe not as much as it was at the beginning of the 20th century, of Bach as being this very meticulous, almost cold rationalist with his music. The way that, you know, all of his music is put together is very, very deliberate. It's very exquisitely perfect, almost. There's very, it's hard to find flaws in Bach's music in a lot of ways, because it's just so damn well conceived. And so people almost treated like Bach as an exercise, like a counterpoint exercise, devoid of emotion. And I feel like that is a very not the best way of approaching it, because there's a lot of emotion to be expressed. Whether or not it's was Bach's emotion or the emotion that he felt like he was trying to express about the glory of God, it's hard to approach the music with that sort of like cold rationalist understanding once you try and inject a little bit more life to it. And that's something that I always think about with when playing Bach's music and listening to Bach's music. So thank you for that comment, though. So this episode has been sponsored by Audioblocks, which is an online stock audio library. And, you know, they wanted me to talk a little bit about it in the video. And I figured the best way of doing that would be to talk about what it is that they do and contextualize it within music history in general. And the way I want to do that is I want to talk about incidental music, which is music that has been composed for the theater. And it's not like musical theater or opera where, you know, you have music which is integrated to the whole performance and very important to the whole experience of the art, but it's rather music which is kind of like background music. It's music that kind of like sneaks underneath certain scenes kind of to accentuate certain emotions versus others to help drive the narrative, or it's kind of like the, you know, connective tissue between scenes, like transitional music. And this practice goes back many millennia. It goes back all the way to the Greeks, but, you know, famous classical composers definitely also composed incidental music. Beethoven composed incidental music. Mendelssohn composed incidental music. And actually, there's a lot of really famous pieces of classical music which were originally written as background music, essentially, for the theater, like In the Hall of the Mountain King or Morning Mood, both by Edvard Grieg, both composed as incidental music for Henrik Ibsen's Peer Gynt. So whenever you see a play today, chances are you will hear some form of incidental music. And whenever I see that happen, I'm kind of reminded of like, well, this kind of sort of feels like a film with a film score. And that's no coincidence because the history of incidental music definitely influenced the aesthetics of film scoring. Film scores are used to set up or subvert emotions on a particular scene, and music definitely goes a long way to driving visual storytelling. And that has translated into the digital age because we've had generations of people who are used to consuming visual media with some form of incidental background music. And it's something that's very important for YouTube creators like myself, and something that I've found out very, very recently. In fact, my previous Q&A video, I omitted background music. I normally compose background music and use my own background music for my videos, but I decided because I was trying out a new sort of format with my video, I wouldn't use the background music. Turns out a lot of people wrote in and said, hey man, where's the background music? I'm so used to seeing what it is that you do with the music in the background, and it felt kind of strange. So it's very important in this digital age, if you are a creator of podcasts or YouTube videos or anything else which might benefit from that sort of extra emotional support. This is where Audioblocks can help, as an online stock audio library where you can download over 100,000 clips of stock audio, including the all-important background music. You can use any kind of music you find on there as incidental music, royalty-free as soon as you download it. And the best part about it is you can continue to use it for as long as you have it, even if you cancel your subscription. There's also loops that you can find on there, which are very useful for musicians, and also, particularly exciting to me, a bunch of funny sound effects, and I'm actually quite excited about using all the sound effects. So if you want to check out what Audioblocks is all about, definitely check out the 7-day free trial, which is going on right now. The link is in the description. You can download anything that you want, and it's also linked right here. So without further ado, back to the main video.
Sagar Kapoor writes,
hey, just out of curiosity, what is your MBTI personality type, if it's not too personal for you to disclose? And do you believe that certain music appeals to certain personality types? Thank you for everything you share on YouTube. It is of great help. Smiley face.
Every time I've taken the test, and I've actually taken it in real life, not just online, but I've taken it in real life and online, every time it's come back INTJ. I'm not exactly sure what all of those mean, but INTJ. And so you can look it up if you want to know more about my personality. But Myers-Briggs personality tests are really interesting because they're a way of kind of categorizing people in terms of their way of reacting to the world around them, which can be kind of useful. I'm not sure if it's how useful it would be for describing somebody's taste in music, but certainly how a person might relate to other people in the field of music in general. So it might be an interesting sort of field of inquiry at some point later down the line. But yeah, INTJ. There we go.
Thomas Vogel writes,
thinking about what you said about historical keys, tunings, and the meaning of A, if we listen today at classical music, is it even what the composers have written or intended it to be?
That's a good question, and actually for the most part, no. You know, today we have modern orchestras with modern instruments, modern tuning, and modern techniques. For example, it's customary now, and has been for a while, for string players to put vibrato on every note that they play because it sounds really nice to our ears. And has been for a while, but, you know, a couple hundred years ago, vibrato was a specific technique. and they played everything with very straight tone, which to our ears sounds very almost scratchy and nasally. And so, you know, if you were going to be playing something with the older techniques, it would sound very different. And there are a bunch of people who like to get into the older techniques and older styles, playing with the lower tunings, playing with period instruments, playing with period techniques, and those are called early music specialists or Baroque specialists. And the music generally sounds very different from what we might normally expect of classical music. It sounds, to my ear, a little rougher, a little rawer, in some ways a lot more exciting too, because there's a lot more rhythmic energy. And, you know, musicians back then would also improvise a fair amount, and that was considered, you're expect to ornament certain things in certain ways, expect to basically change the music off the page based upon personal preference, which is not necessarily something that we think of today. We always think about composer's intent. But that's like, you know, with the romantic notion of composer's artistic expression, that's a more modern understanding of the role of the composer and the artistic musician. So it's very different. And you should check out people who are trying to do period and early music tuning and performance techniques, because it is quite an interesting body of work that I admittedly don't know a whole lot about, but check it out anyway.
Morpheus X writes, I think all the Wikipedia descriptions of vaporwave being a serious critique on consumer culture are more or less post hoc attributions by people trying to make it into more than it actually is. I think vaporwave is an earnest, salacious expression of the nostalgia of a generation raised on TV and dial-up internet.
Yeah, so vaporwave is clearly not anti-capitalist in any regard. And if you think so, please feel free to disagree with me in the comments. But from what I've seen, it's a full-on nostalgia gorge. People are engorging themselves with 90s internet culture and appropriating it for a new era, but it is a total embrace. It's a total embrace of that consumer culture for the purposes of getting that hypnagogic feeling, that creepy chill-out vibe. And I can kind of prove it, that it's not anti-capitalist in any way, shape, or form, and it's not sort of like, that's not the purpose of the music, and that's not the purpose of the movement, because we'll just take a look at the comments section of my vaporwave video and take a look at the main critique of the music that I was making, which was purporting to be vaporwave. It wasn't vaporwave at all, I admit, and I said so in the video, but basically I had Luke, the drummer, play a very bombastic drum part, and I mixed the drums very bombastically and very like aggressively, and the whole track itself had none of the chill out qualities of a typical vaporwave track. It is definitely not vaporwave in that sense. So for all of the like sounds and all of like the, you know, irony with the Kmart samples and all of that stuff and all of, like, the potential like layers of meaning with like the KKK KKK at the end where I'm like putting that in and social commentary and all of that stuff, not a single comment was about any of it. All of it was about the drums. All of it was saying, you have the wrong vibe for vaporwave with the drums. These drums are too loud. They didn't get me in the right vibe. And that's fine. That's great. But that means that vaporwave has, that just as a cultural movement, has absolutely no social commentary. There is no capitalist, there's no anti-establishment anything to vaporwave. It is a full-on embrace of it, which is fine. That's totally fine, but nobody should kid themselves, honestly, on it. It is like pop art, like Andy Warhol. It is a full-on embrace of that consumer culture.
FOP writes, I had a dream yesterday, and in it, you were the host of a cooking show. I guess two of my hobbies got switched up, or rather, mixed together. One question, why didn't you use the juice of the grapefruit in the marinade? You just threw it away. It seemed quite wasteful.
You're not actually the only person who's asked that. I actually really dislike the taste of grapefruit. Now, any other kind of citrus works really well in any kind of poultry marinade, but for me personally, grapefruit is just not...
Koshevik writes, how do you play in mean tone and other tunings with MIDI? I've been trying to do it on Ableton recently, but I couldn't find a good way to do it.
I used Mainstage. It's a fairly powerful tool, actually, for alternative tunings. It can be kind of tricky to use alternative tunings with other programs. It's just very difficult. You have to, like, manually tune things, and it's a pain in the ass. But Mainstage makes it a lot easier. You can experiment with things like 5-limit tuning or Pythagorean tuning, all sorts of fun stuff. So yeah, check it out. Main Stage.
Chris Moraga writes, dude, you have an amazing knowledge of music. Do you have a DMA? If not, are you planning on pursuing one? Longtime fan, BTW.
So I don't have a DMA, and I probably won't get a DMA. I do have a master's degree. And the main reason why somebody would want to get a doctorate in music is if they wanted to be able to teach at the university level. And that's great. And I do want to teach at the university level. That is definitely a big career goal of mine. But at the same time, you can teach at the university level with just a master's degree or even just a bachelor's of music degree if you're that high of an artistic caliber, and especially, you know, something like music. Now, you know, my chosen field of jazz or electronic music or new music media or some sort of like combination of it, all of those, there really aren't that many doctorates that would fulfill like my desire to teach in any one of those fields. There are like doctorates in jazz at like Manhattan School of Music or New England Conservatory and some others. But at the same time, I don't really think that that sort of like extreme academic specialization is necessary for what I want to do. And if you notice, for all of my videos, I don't have any extreme academic specialization in any one particular thing. I just do a pretty broad exploration of many different kinds of topics in a, you know, fairly academic way. So at some point, maybe, who knows, but I really don't think that that's on the horizon for me.
Justin Hung writes, hi Adam, I'm wondering if you can talk about your experience auditioning for music school. Since you went to school for composition, is the format different than, say, more performance-based instruments such as bass? I'm in the application process myself, and any insight you can give would be greatly appreciated.
Yeah, so for me at Berklee, from what I remember, I think it's the same audition for everybody. It doesn't matter if it's business or music production or performance or whatever, everybody has the same performance audition, which, you know, I think that's pretty much across the board for a lot of undergraduate programs, mainly because students don't really become super specialized in any one particular thing until a little bit later on in their academic career anyway. So most schools just want to make sure that you can play your instrument. That's usually the baseline. It doesn't even matter if you're a business major. A lot of, you know, if you're getting a music degree, you want to be able to say, like, hey, I can actually play this musical instrument. At the graduate level, however, when I went to the Manhattan School of Music, it was very different. I did have to do a performance-based audition, pre-audition. They called it a pre-screening, which meant that I had to, like, prove that I could play and send in the tape. And then once I could prove that I played, then they would invite me back for a composition audition, which involved, let's say 3 or 4 hours of like pretty intensive ear training and theory tests. I had to compose something based upon a prompt within like an hour. I was just given a room with a piano and I had to compose something. What else? I had to like sit in front of a panel of professors and defend my portfolio of compositions. It was pretty intense all day sort of affair. And I know when people sit for their like doctoral auditions, it can be like 2 or 3 days worth of stuff that they have to do. So that's kind of my audition experience for a composition major. It's similar, obviously, on the undergraduate level, but very different from normal performance majors when you're talking about grad school.
The Magical Cake writes, why do you have an E-flat reel book rather than a standard reel book if all you play is bass, guitar, and piano?
So I got the E-flat reel book as just a means to see if I couldn't test my brain, to see if I couldn't transpose and learn to transpose E-flat parts, just as an exercise, really. So basically for alto saxophone, which is an E-flat transposing instrument, whenever you play a C on alto saxophone, it comes out sounding like a concert E-flat. It sounds like an E-flat for the rest of us, but they're thinking about it as a C. So you have to have a specific kind of sheet music transposed for them so that everything ends up sounding right. Now, that's fine, whatever, and I got the E-flat reel book, but then I very quickly came to the realization that there's a shortcut that kind of destroyed the, you know, exercise of it. Now I didn't really have to think about it so much, which was like, oh, that was the entire purpose of me getting the book. The shortcut's this. If you take the note A and you pretend to play an A on an alto sax, or you actually play the note A on an alto sax, you can see it on an E-flat transposing, like real book or E-flat transposing sheet music, as the second space on the treble clef. That's great. That's an A, second space on the treble clef. But when you play it, it out comes a C. That's just the nature of an E-flat instrument. When you see an A and you play it, it out comes a C. The big problem is that if you just pretend that the treble clef is actually a bass clef, the second space in the bass clef is also a C. So you don't actually have to think about anything. You just pretend that the treble clef on an E-flat part is a bass clef, and then you don't have to think about anything. There's some like weird issues with like accidentals and keys and whatnot, but that's like the basic gist of the whole matter. And when I came to that realization, I was like, oh, well, now I don't have to think about anything, which is great, but that was the entire purpose of me getting this E-flat real book. So now I just have an E-flat real book. For no particular reason. I have no desire to start up alto saxophone, so it's just there.
Wheelie writes, Adam, do you know people who worked on a cruise ship as a musician? I find mixed opinions on that matter.
I've never done a cruise ship gig, and, you know, with some exceptions, most of my colleagues have had actually pretty good experiences on their cruise ship gigs when they have done them. And when you're fresh out of school, doing a cruise ship thing can be pretty darn, you know, awesome, at least from where I see it, because, you know, you're saving a bunch of money because you're not spending money on room or board. You're honing your skills as a musician. And, you know, if you have the right group of people, it can be quite fun. But at the same time, once you start trying to develop a career as a musician beyond just saving money, you know, cruise ship gig does nothing whatsoever for your network in terms of people that you're going to be playing with on land. It does very little for advancing yourself in terms of the other kinds of gigs that you might be able to get later on. And whenever you start some sort of network and start some sort of career in a particular city and become known for certain things and have certain contacts in terms of musicians and playing with certain bands, if you go and take a cruise ship then, don't expect any of that to be waiting for you when you come back. You're going to have to start from scratch every time. And that's something that I've seen happen many times. And it can be quite discouraging because it feels like, you know, somebody goes off into limbo land and then they expect everything else that, you know, they had when they went away to be there. And it's not people move on. People find other people to play with. And so I would suggest if you are, you know, young, if you're trying to get a start in music, either out of school or if you're just trying to like make a go of it, definitely go and try and get a cruise ship gig because they're awesome. And also check out Josh Fossgreen, I think is his name's, videos on cruise ship gigs because he was a cruise ship musician for a while and he has some great like vloggy type things explaining his experience. That was really interesting because I'd never done them, so I learned a lot about what it means to be a cruise ship musician, what his experience was. So definitely check out those YouTube videos if you are at all interested.
Jeremy Keaton writes, Hey Adam, as a student in music school right now, I've been wondering what gigging musicians like you do if you end up sick the day of a gig. Do you just have to power through it or do you have to find a suitable replacement last minute?
So that's one of the unfortunate things about being a freelancer in general, not necessarily just being a musician, but freelancer. You kind of have to weigh your own health against the prospect of making money with a gig. And that's, you know, just an ugly aspect of capitalist society. You just kind of have to learn to deal with. Now, fortunately for musicians, it's a very community-based sort of business. So it's important for anybody to have a list of subs to, you know, that you trust to be able to step it up when you might get injured or sick. So I have a list of bass player friends of mine who I know would just kill it on like 30 minutes notice. Not even, just if they're able to like get to the gig, they will be able to do a pretty damn amazing job of making their way through it, having not rehearsed or anything. That's just kind of what you have to deal with, unfortunately.
Trellis Rose writes, Would somebody with social anxiety survive at a music college, specifically Berklee, or even get accepted? I'm always told that I need to learn to talk to people to go, and that they only really want outgoing people at their college.
So I'm sorry about this, introverts, but I'm about to deliver some unfortunate news to you. As a performing musician, you have to be extroverted. You have to show some degree of extroversion in order to succeed. You know, a big name of the game is networking, figuring out what other people might want from you and being able to deliver it, meeting a bunch of people. You know, you're a small business. You have to, you know, advertise your small business, advertise your brand of you being the musician and figuring, you know, making sure other people know what it is that you do. Now, that said, I don't say, you know, you don't have to be an extrovert. You have to be extroverted, which is, I feel like, more of a verb than an adjective. You have to have the necessary social skills in order to interact with other people and learn those social skills because that's very necessary. That's just a fact of the matter. You know, earlier on in the video, I said that I was INTJ, right? I stands for introversion. I am an introvert. If I had my way, I would just sit alone in a dark room all day playing bass and composing. That sounds like a great thing. That sounds amazing to me. I am in a dark room. The light has changed. But, you know, I'm showing some degree of extroversion right now by talking to a camera and by performing the act of extroversion. When I turn the camera off, I'm probably not going to say anything. I'm probably going to be completely beat and completely tired from this sort of display of outward affection to the world and outward affection to other people. But that's just something that you have to learn. That's just something that's a big part of being a, you know, a musician in general.
Mario Nikolov writes, "Hey Adam, I work as a cruise ship musician and sometimes my band wants me to slap. But every time I do it, I sound too loud and they regret it. So do you have a solution for this? I am usually plugged directly in the amp, no effects."
Easy fix is just get a compressor pedal and you'll be amazed at how much more even your tone is, especially for things like slap.
Jennifer Wade writes, "Hey Adam, classical violinist here who happens to love your channel, not only for the really interesting musical content, but for painting such an honest picture of the music business. Just a quick comment in response to the whole 3 hours of playing thing. I completely agree with you that playing for that long is taxing mentally and physically. Those breaks are necessary, which is all the more reason I have mad respect for opera musicians. Yeah, I know I'm going all classical on you, but seriously, I had a bunch of friends playing the Ring Cycle this past year at the Kennedy Center, and I marvel at their stamina. Nothing about that is easy, so it tends to humble me when I'm sitting in a rehearsal looking at my watch. As far as I'm concerned, that level of focus and concentration is the equivalent of ascended master in musicians' terms."
Yes, of course. There are definitely instances where you have, especially in classical music, operatic literature, you have these crazy long segments without intermission, 3 hours or longer, and that's insane. It's absolutely insane. And of course, the biggest respect goes to the musicians who are able to do that, and they do it as a labor of love, realizing that that's necessary in order to do the particular art that they want to do. And of course, they're getting paid pretty decently for it too, but you know, that's a choice on their part. If the difference is this, though, they physically aren't playing the entire time. Even if it's this 3 hour long thing, the first violins are not playing for all 3 hours. There are moments of respite. If I'm playing a 3 hour cover gig, I'm playing the entire length of time. I'm also standing the entire length of time. So it's a very different thing in terms of physical stamina. It's kind of an apples and oranges comparison because I don't want to denigrate anything that any artist does when they're playing something like that, something absurd like that. But I do want to say that there is a more of a reason for a musician to put up with 3 hours of playing like the Ring Cycle versus 3 hours of playing a bar gig without break.
Kynaston Zelfie Jameson writes, "Would you want to try being a professional musician in a different country? I heard being a professional musician in Singapore pays quite well." Smiley face.
So thank you for mentioning Singapore, because it's actually a great place to talk about my thoughts on this. A friend of mine, Joan Chu, is Singaporean, and she's living in New York. And you know, before moving to New York, she was making a lot of money playing weddings and events in Singapore. And I asked her, like, "Whoa, why would you, you know, move to New York, make no money when you could be making so much money back home?" And she was like, "Well, the musicianship here in New York is so much better. I feel so much better about playing music here, so I'm willing to give that up because it was just really poor music and really cheesy and not and very soul crushing." Playing all that stuff back in Singapore. And usually that's the trade-off that I've heard of and seen, making a fair amount of money playing really cheesy music or making no money playing awesome music with awesome musicians. And, you know, if my goal was to make a lot of money, I wouldn't be a musician. My goal is to make money as a musician, but that's not my primary goal as a musician. I'm primarily looking to play with really amazing people trying to make really good music.
Motinum writes, "Hey Adam, can you include me on the next Q&A?
Sure thing. And that's it. Thank you very much for watching this week's Q&A. Thank you to this week's sponsor, Audioblocks, and also thank you very much to my loyal patrons, these guys down below. It is through them that I'm able to make these videos week after week, so thank you very much if you have supported to my Patreon campaign. If you enjoy what I do, please comment, please like, and subscribe. I do read the comments. There are a lot of them, so if I didn't get a chance to answer your question, please, it's nothing personal, just ask it again on another video. I will get around to it, so thank you very much for asking questions. So until next time, which will be, I don't know, maybe I got a gig vlog coming up. We shall see.
Peace.